I could have your attention. We're going to start with the peripheral nerve injury class. You know who I am, Patty McGlinchey. On my slide, I'm not telling the full truth. It says the final neuro day. Well, not really, because we have that other class on Friday. But for those of you that are sad that we're nearing the end, do not fear. We will have more neuro at the end of the course. And I know there's one person out there that likes neuro. There might be more closet neuro people. This is a great career. Keep this in mind. A lot of people transfer from sports medicine orthopedics because they find neuro patients fascinating. All right, you got objectives in your handout? The objective that I have in teaching this class is I want you to understand what happens to a peripheral nerve when it gets injured, physiologically, what's going on there, so that when you have a patient with a peripheral nerve injury, you're going to understand why it takes so long and why there are so many problems involved in their rehab. That's key for me. The other half of this class is talking about peripheral nerve neuropathies, meaning things that go wrong with peripheral nerves. And it's not just all about traumatic injuries. It's everything from diabetes to genetic diseases. So I want you to have a general understanding of these diseases and trauma injuries so that you'll be able to treat the patient as best you can. Many of these things you're going to hear again as you get to different regions of the body. Some of them you're only going to hear this one time. So you have all your learning steps. The class follows it. And always we start with a bit of a review, which is reviewing from almost a half hour ago. So, neural process. I throw that word out there, but what I use more instead of the word neural process is the word axon or dendrite. And I use axon a lot more than dendrite. Have you noticed that? We don't really talk about the dendrites much. Mostly it's the axons that are involved. Dendrites are just like antennas. They just pull it in, pull in that impulse. It's the axon that has a lot going on with it. So we're going to be talking a lot about that axon in this class because that's where a lot of the pathology is. The axolemma. What is that? Lemma. Cell membrane of the axon. So the whole entire neuron has a cell membrane. But the axon itself, that membrane is a little bit different. The permeability is a little different. And so therefore it has a special name, the axolemma. Neurolemma, or neurilemma, what's that? Membrane of Schwann cell. Schwann cell is what produces the myelination of the peripheral nerves. It wraps around the axon. Real tight wrapping on the innermost areas and then in the outermost areas where you see the cytoplasm. But the outer part of that, the neurolemma, is your cell membrane that surrounds that outer part of the whole wrapping process. So you could call it the cell membrane of the Schwann cell. But a lot of times I'm going to refer to it just as the outermost part. But it really is the whole cell membrane, your neurolemma. And do you find that in your central nervous system? That's peripheral. What produces myelin in the central nervous system? Okay, the oligodendrocyte. And that produces it in a different way. It's really the same sort of structure, but you don't have the same tight wrapping thing going on. It does wrap around, but it's not the same way. So it's a little bit different in its anatomy. Function-wise, it works the same, whether it be central or peripheral. All right, so myelin, you know what that is. Speeds up transmission, right? What else would speed up the transmission of an action potential? Heat and size. When I talk about size, am I talking length? Diameter. Okay, it's the diameter that's important. Okay. Coverings. We just got through talking about this, the little models going around. You have three connective tissue coverings over a nerve. The one that's most important for this class is the innermost one. What's that one called? Endonorion. And where is that in relation to the myelin? over it. Over it. So you have axon, myelin, and then endonorium. Okay? It's the outermost of those structures. Take a bunch of neurons, bundle them together according to their function, and what's going to surround those neurons? Perineurium. I'm working my way out. Take all those bundles of neurons. Oh, I forgot to tell you what the bundles are called. Fascicles. How could I have missed that? That was in the last handout. Fascicles. That's what that bundle is called. And you're going to hear that again. We use the same, guys, we use the same term with muscles. Fascicles. So you take that bundle, that fascicle of neurons, take all of them, add some blood vessels in, maybe a little fat, surround that with connective tissue covering. What's that covering called? Epineurium. That's the outermost. So that's the outermost boundary of the peripheral or the spinal nerve. All right. And there's the same picture you saw just a few moments ago. Deja vu. Okay, so injuries. We're getting right into the stuff here. You can have nerve, peripheral nerve problems. Not all of them are traumatic injuries. But if they are traumatic injuries, how do they occur? They occur from traction, which means they get stretched. Nerve tissue is not muscle tissue. It does not stretch and spring back. It stretches and rips. It does have a little bit of elasticity. It can stretch about 10% of its length. That's not much, okay, from what our body does. That allows the joints to move for their full range of motion. Is what that allows. It doesn't allow for anything beyond joint range of motion. So traction is one way you can injure a nerve. You stretch it too much. The next way is compression. Put pressure on a nerve and you decrease the amount of blood flow going to that portion of the nerve. You have ischemia of the actual neurotissue, and it can only take so much. After so much, it actually dies, and you have death of neurotissue. Okay, so that's another way, and that compression can be prolonged compression, like you have in a carpal tunnel syndrome, or it can be a one-time compression. Something presses down real hard on it. Or you guys do some compression all the time, right? You put your arm in a funny position, okay, and you hit that, or you compress the funny bone area there, that nerve, you blunt trauma. So you've done a lot of these peripheral nerve injuries, hopefully not severe. The next one down makes perfect sense. You can have a laceration, a severance of a peripheral nerve. To do this, you would need something like a knife to sever it. Something would have to actually cut it. When you have a severance of a nerve, you have damage not just of the neurotissue, but those coverings around the neurotissue. So now you're damaging the endoneurium, perineurium, epineurium, as well as the nerve itself, the neurotissue, the neuron itself. With the other two, you can just have, with traction and compression, you can just damage the neuron and not the connective tissue. But with a severance, you definitely got them all. All right? The last one down there, burn. We're electrical burns. That's what I'm talking about here. We're not going to get into this form of nerve injury. It really takes a whole separate class in order to talk about that. And you will have a class on burn injuries, I believe. Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think you do have a class on burn injuries. But you do get to go to the burn center here on POST and learn on-the-job training when you're there. All right, so those are your traumatic injuries that occur to a peripheral nerve. But later in the class, we're going to talk about the non-traumatic, the infections of peripheral nerves, the toxin poisoning of peripheral nerves, the metabolic, and some genetic as well. So we'll get into some more, but right now, what I'm going to talk about is mainly looking at traumatic nerve injuries, what happens, and how they repair. This is more your musculoskeletal type. All right, this is the part that everyone hates, these three terms. This class is really not that hard, but the terms make it look hard. Neuropraxia, axonotomesis, and neurotomesis. Ugh. All right, just the terms are hard. Thankfully, it's a multiple choice test. You do not have to spell these. took me forever to learn how to spell axonotomesis and nortomesis. I kept putting the T and the O the other way. All right. What these terms refer to are different degrees of nerve injury. And they go from least to worst in this list. So a neuropraxia is something we've all had. Axonotomesis, probably not. Neurotenesis, I would say definitely not, based on what I've seen. But you never know. All right, starting with the most mildest degree of injury, neuropraxia. What happens here is your Schwann cell, what produces the myelin, it actually splits. So we have a rupture of the cell membrane of the Schwann cell, and that myelin, that wrapping, it herniates. It just messes up the Schwann cell with a neuropraxia. But there's no problem with the axon or the endonorium. They stay fine. All the problems are right there with the Schwann cell. It does produce inflammation. With inflammation, you get some swelling, you get edema. That's part of inflammation. And together, the myelin disruption, the inflammation and edema causes a block of the conduction. A block. That's all. The mechanism of injury of a neuropraxia is typically compression, but it could be a mild traction and it could be something that is metabolic or toxin related, but it's typically a compression, and that's how we've all experienced it, and you'll know what I mean when I talk about it. The actual conduction of the neuron is intact, so the action potential can travel down the axon still. It just is dysfunctional. It doesn't travel the same way. So the symptoms the patient's going to talk about are those falling asleep symptoms, like my arm feels dead, it feels like it's asleep. You've all had that. You've been sitting for a long time and you stand up and you're like, you got pins and needles in your foot, you feel like the ants are crawling up your skin. Paresthesias is the term for it. Conduction is still intact, but it's dysfunctional. It's not the same normal type of conduction. It usually recovers in minutes. Depending on the degree of myelin disruption, it could take months. A lot of that, too, depends on the size, the diameter of the nerve. Okay? So typically, this is something short-lived, but it could take longer. And when it takes longer, sometimes it's hard to decide, is it a neuropraxia or an axonotomesis? Anatomically, they're two different things, this category and the next one. But symptomatically, they can look similar if it's one of those neuropraxias that takes a while to recover. We're going to look at a bunch of neuropraxias after I get done talking about the actual anatomy and physiology, and some of them are funny. Okay, axonotomesis, the next level of nerve injury. Getting more severe here. With this one, the axon itself is disrupted, but the endonorium that covers it is not. So would it be a severance that causes this? No. Okay? No. With this one, the mechanism of injury is, again, usually compression or traction. No severance listed there. When you have a severance, you're interrupting that endonorium. In this case, endonorium is intact. It's the axon that gets disruptive. And in this case, the conduction is disrupted too. The action potential will only go to the place of injury where that axon is injured, and it will go no farther. Conduction is disrupted. So we're not dealing with the weird feeling, the ants, the numbness. We're dealing with no feeling. Okay? Recovery on this one can take a while, at least months, maybe up to a year. A lot of it depends on where the injury occurs. If it occurs very distal on the axon, like right where the axon's about to get to its receptor or its muscle, then the recovery is pretty quick. But if it occurs far away from where that axon terminal is, it's got a longer recovery. You'll understand that as we continue here. But the recovery potential is actually very good. It all depends on if that tube is intact or not, that endonorium tube. And in an axonotomesis, by definition, it is. So recovery is usually very, very good. We'll get into all these other things in just a moment. I want to talk more about the stages first. And the next one is neurotomesis. This is the severe one. This is the one you don't want and you don't want your patients to have because prognosis is poor. But I'm hopping. Let's go back. What happens with this one anatomically is the axon is disrupted as well as the endonorium. So you have major disruption here. In fact, typically what's happening is the entire nerve, peripheral nerve, talking a bunch of neurons, are disrupted, and the endonorium of all of them is disrupted. Okay, this is a major nerve injury here. The mechanism is usually a severance or a laceration. That means the same thing. It could also be very severe traction. Okay, I don't even want to think about it. And then severe compression, and this is what happens with burn injuries as well. So recovery for this one is really poor. If there's no surgery, you're talking like severely poor. With surgery, it's still, it's iffy. It's really iffy. Depends on the skills of the surgeon and how clean the injury is. Okay, so there's a lot of variability with the surgery, but we're still looking at something that's not very good. Alrighty. Now, I might deviate a little bit in my slideshow from what I'm talking about here, but I think I'm going to be right on. So with neuropraxias, the key thing is that you have an axon intact, right? I'm going back a little bit. That's the mildest one. With axonotomesis, what's intact? This is the mild one. I mean, the in-between one, the moderate? The endonorium's intact. The axon's disrupted, but the endonorium's intact. Now, the most severe, everything's disrupted. Good. It's time for us to take a break then. All right, everybody. Let's come on back here. We're going to pick up where we left off. Folks? Folks, thank you. Okay, let's see how much short-term memory you have. We had 10 minutes of break. So, of the three different stages of peripheral nerve injury, which is the least, the mildest? Neuropraxia. Which of the three do you have a disruption or an insult to the axon and the endonorium? Neurotomesis. Yeah, that's a fun one to say, isn't it? Neurotomesis. Say it. Neurotomesis. Okay, so then you have the one in the middle. The one in the middle has an injury or of those two structures, axon and endonorium. Which one is disrupted? The axon. Good. Okay, so keep that in mind. Of the three, which one do you still have conduction down the axon? The neuropraxia, the mildest form. Now, the conduction's going to be dysfunctional. It's not going to be the same, but you will still have conduction. It will feel like that numbness, that tingling sensation. Okay, what we're going to do now is talk about the phases of a nerve repair. First of all, if it's a neuropraxia, where the axon's not disrupted, the endonorium's not disrupted, all that's disrupted is really the myelin, and that produces the inflammation and swelling. In that case, it just takes a little while for the myelin to repair itself, and it can. So the Schwann cell repairs itself, the swelling to go down, and presto, you're done, you're repaired. That's all there is to it. So that's for your neuropraxias. For the other two, we got a whole lot of other stuff going on. You see the list that's up there. We're going to go through some different stages. We're going to go through chromatolysis, I can say that word, Wallerian degeneration, and then maybe retrograde degeneration. That's a maybe stage. And then there'll be it's going to be a fun day. Sequential recovery. That's what's going to happen. So let's go through all those different things and talk about them. Chromatolysis, I'm not even going to say it anymore. This is when the neuron's cell body swells up as a result of that injury to the axon. This happens with not your neuropraxias. This happens with your axonotomesis and your neurotomesis. So your axon is disrupted. As a response to that, the cell body of the neuron is going to swell. Why does it swell? Because it's creating more organelles. The repairing organelle, which is the Neisel body, it creates more of those, which causes a swelling of the cell body. In response to that, those nesyl bodies is going to help with the repair of the axon. It's like getting the construction crew in there, okay? This swelling will occur pretty soon after the injury, but it might take several hours. I have 6 hours down there. It usually starts happening within that time frame, but there is some variance in there. But it happens soon after you have the swelling. So that's step one, getting ready for the repair, calling in the repairmen, so to say. The next step, while layering degeneration, is looking at the axon itself. From the area of injury distally, that axon will disappear. That's Wallerian degeneration. It's there at first, right after the injury. It's still there. But over time, over a series of hours, it starts to kick in where it starts to break down. Just that area from injury distally. It breaks down into little particles, and then it gets cleaned up from there. Now, this occurs to the axon, but it also occurs to the myelin, too, in a way. Okay, so the whole thing kind of breaks down, disintegrates, and then the Schwann cells will start multiplying. They have a little multiplication party. They start creating more Schwann cells, and they line up in that endonorium tube, if it's still there. Okay, so with an axotemesis, is the endonorium still there? Yeah, that's your mild one. I mean, your moderate one. So you still have the endonorium tube. The Schwann cells will multiply and they'll line up within that tube. They don't block the tube. They line the periphery of it. They're getting ready for something. If you don't have the tube, well, then you got a problem. Okay, we'll get into that. The conduction, as soon as the Wallerian degeneration occurs, the conduction of that axon cannot happen anymore. But interestingly, right after the injury, you could still have some conduction of that axon. You could still have a period where it feels funny, dysfunctional, the ants, the tingling. So it could feel like a neuropraxia. But once that Wallerian degeneration occurs, you won't have anything. So initially, the patient might say, well, I have numbness and tingling. And then a couple hours later, I'm losing it. I don't get it. I don't feel anything. That's when you know you have an axotemesis or a neurotemesis. All right, so Wallerian degeneration, it breaks up. Retrograde degeneration talks about what happens at the site of injury and proximal, so going back towards the cell body. Now, this may or may not happen. It depends on the severity of the injury. When your more severe axonotomesis and your neurotomesis, you're going to see it happen. And what occurs here is the axon proximal to the injury starts to break up, degeneration. And it may just break up to the next node of Ranvier, or it may break up even farther. It depends on the severity of the injury, how much trauma that neuron's gone through, as to how much retrograde degeneration there is. The same thing happens with the Schwann cells. Those along that proximal part, if there's degeneration there, the Schwann cells will multiply and line in the endonorium tube. All right, so we've been talking a lot of breaking down. I kind of think of construction here. Before you can build the new house, you got to get rid of all the old stuff. That's what's occurring with these degenerations. Wallerian is from injury site distal. Retrograde is injury site proximal, to whatever degree, depending on the injury. So then, we got it all removed. Now it's time to build again. In the cell body, you've had the swelling occur, organelles getting poised, ready, multiplying. These are your nesyl bodies. What will happen, it reminds me of that lizard. You're going to see budding of the axon. Little axon buds coming out of the most distal part of what's left of the axon. Little buds protruding. There'll be a couple of them, maybe four, maybe more. It really depends on the neuron. And they're all going to be looking for something. What do you think they're going to be looking for? Yeah. And even more specifically, what are the Schwann cells lining? The endonorium tube. They're looking for the tube to grow into. When they find the tube, when one of them finds the tube, the others will stop growing. And the one that found the tube will become your new axon, growing out along the tube to get to wherever it's going. If it's an afferent neuron, what is it going to go to? The place where it innervated for the skin or whatever receptor area. So it actually grows out, forms a new receptor. If it's a motor efferent neuron, it's going to the muscle or the gland. We're going to call that an effector. It's going to its effector, its muscle or gland. So it keeps growing, and it grows distally, little bit by little bit. And that tube guides it along the way. This happens within about 24 hours after injury. So immediately after injury or within a few hours, the swelling begins. The word I don't like to say, the chromatolysis. After that, you have the degeneration occurring. Wallerian degeneration from injury site distally, retrograde from injury site proximally, maybe occurring. And then you have the buds starting within 24 hours. One of them finds the tube, that one takes over, the others don't grow anymore, and you have your new axon growing. The rate of growth varies on how these axons grow, but the average rate of growth is 1.5 millimeters a day. Okay, think of your rulers, go to the centimeter side, think of how big a millimeter is. Not very big, right? You can hardly even do it with your fingertips, right? 1.5 millimeters a day. You must have patience with these regrowing neurons. Patience. So now, and to add to that, typically it grows fast initially and then it slows down. Okay, so it's varying too. But add to that, it depends on where the injury is on the axon. You have some really long axons out there, and you have some short ones. Let's say we have an axon that's going, it has its cell body in, we'll make it a motor neuron. So now we're going to have to bring up some of the tracks here, okay? Lower motor neuron, where's the cell body located? Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Ventral horn, we're in the spinal cord. Horny butterfly, the ventral horn's your motor horn. That's where the cell body's located. Axon comes out the ventral root, spinal nerve. After the spinal nerve, it's going to go ventral primary ramus or dorsal primary ramus. We're going to the arm, so which of the two is it going to pick? It doesn't really pick. Which is it wired to? Ventral primary ramus. Dorsal just goes to that strip in the back. Ventral. It's going to go through the plexus, come out in the peripheral nerve. Let's say we're going all the way to supinator muscle, down in the wrist. Okay, going a long ways. We got a long axon here. If the injury's up at the shoulder, think of how far that axon's going to have to grow. How many days will it take? You got to get out the ruler and measure the patient's arm and give them an estimate. Okay, a millimeter and a half a day on an average. If conditions are good, if the moons are aligned, okay? What if the injury's down here at the wrist? Yeah, shorter time. So, it's a couple slides from now. I have a question that asks that, and it always boggles my mind because I always get it wrong. Even though I understand this, the wording of the question's funny. Okay, so looking at this, these are the pictures you have in your handout. Hopefully the pictures help you along in understanding this growth and recovery. It's really not that complex. You got to clean up the bad stuff, get it all out of there, and build some new. And you have the guide. You have your endonorium tube to guide the growth, get it where it's going. Simple, right? Sure. So why do I say our patients have such poor prognoses when you have not an axotenesis, but a neurotenesis? Why would there be a problem, folks? What do you think? Okay, and not so much even the swan cell, because he's got it right, but the endonorium tube. If you don't have that tube, the swan cells have nothing to line. They don't know what to do, as if they had a brain, right? They don't know what to do. So you don't have that tube, that budding neuron, got those little buds out there looking for their tube. They can't find their tube. So what do? No, they do this. They wind, they twine around themselves. They make a ball. And that doesn't do anything, does it? They're not going to the effector. They're not going to where the receptor should be. Just a total mess. Total mess. Dysfunctional, doesn't grow back. So if you have a neurotenesis where the endonorium tube has been severed, key thing here is connect the tube. All right? Connect the tube. That's what surgery does. So neurotenesis without surgery, chances are slim that those buds are going to find the endonorium. The endonorium might be there, but it might be a centimeter away. Might even be half a centimeter away. Those buds going to find it? No. Okay? Especially with all the swelling and trauma in the area? No. So they do surgery on the neurotenesis to bring the tubes together. Now, is that what the surgeon's looking for, the tube, to sew the tube? No, I mean, that's like microscopic. What they're doing is sewing the severed ends of the nerve together with hope that the tubes line up. You can see why the prognosis stinks, okay? What if they put a little torsion on the nerve as they bring it in? We're going to have tubes lining up? No. We still might get lucky because, remember, they're bundled in fascicles, all these neurons, so the functions are pretty similar within a fascicle. So if they're off just a little bit, you still have a motor neuron going into a motor neuron tube. May not be the exact same one it's supposed to, but at least function-wise, we're in the same thing. And the brain can actually adjust for that. If it grows back to the wrong muscle, the brain can adjust to that. It takes some time. You actually have to teach the patient how to do it, too. You have to do some rehab. But it can work. But if you have a motor neuron growing into the endonorium tube for a sensory neuron, no function. You're not going to restore function. Or vice versa. It's just not going to happen. So we're talking about some tricky stuff here with surgery. So with surgery, they do it when there's a neurotenesis. The idea is, if there's no tube, no luck. So they're trying to get the tube together so that the little buds don't just ball up. But they have to get the lining up to occur. They try their best. Go from there. There's also an ability to take a nerve graft and bridge a gap. Okay, see, now we're putting another facet into here too. So now we're not getting the same nerve lining up with the same nerve. We're putting another nerve with its organization, and you're just kind of crossing your fingers and hoping. Okay, and I'd be honest, I mean, I've seen this work. So I'm giving a pretty dismal presentation here, but function usually does return with surgery. It's just not 100%. Something gets back, something's better than nothing. Okay, but we're not looking at the greatest process here. Let me see what I forgot to say about surgery. That's pretty much it for surgery. Okay, so prognosis overall with all your traumatic nerve injuries, traumatic here, with your neuropraxias, mildest form, your compression neuropraxias, most of them are compression, and your mild axotenesis. You're looking at a 90% recovery rate within 4 months. That's pretty good. Okay, 90%, I'll take that. That's good. Because those other 10%, they're probably recovering to some degree, but not to satisfaction. Okay, but they got some function, though. Your axotenesis is in general, just looking at that category, those that have the axon disrupted, but not the endonorium, 80 to 50% of those will recover. That's the positive way of saying. I got the negative up there. 20 to 50%, those nerves will actually die. They won't recover. So with axotenesis, you know, you're looking at 50% or better recovery rate. Not great, not bad. When you have surgery involved, there's just a lot of problems. besides the ones I've mentioned, there's another problem. The growth rate. And this is actually for the axotemesis as well. For any of them that have the budding and the axon has to return back, the longer the return, the longer the growth that has to occur, the more time you give for other problems to set in. Those other problems are scarring. Anywhere along that neuroendonorium tube, scarring can set in. And it does, unfortunately. And if you have any sort of scarring, it's a mechanical block. The axon cannot grow past it. So the longer the axon that has to grow, the more chance of scarring, the prognosis goes down. The other problem is an innervated muscle, a muscle that does not have a nerve giving it impulses so the muscle contracts, over time will start to change in its composition. It will start to fibrose, which means the muscle cells die and they're replaced by connective tissue. So if we have a long time of growth here, by the time that axon bud reaches the muscle itself may not have the properties to contract like it used to. So you end up with a weaker muscle, even if the nerve growth went 100%. So anything that has a long time prognosis, you're looking at additional problems with scarring and muscle damage. Happy thoughts, huh? Okay. Luckily, you really don't run into a lot of these. You really don't. Traumatic problems. Now, military, we just put ourselves in the lifestyle, okay, where we're more prone to it. So civilians see even less of this than the military, but you don't see a whole lot of it. And like I said before, overall, even if you do get function back, it's typically not full or 100%. Okay, happy thoughts. This is the question. See how you do. What will take longer to remyelinate? And when I say that, I'm also talking about regrowth. That's the weird part of the question, but it just which one will take longer to grow back? An injury close to the cell body, an injury far away from the cell body. Which one takes longer? How many say A? You have to think it through. How many say B? Okay, I dare not even give you my answer, but I have it. Yes, I'm right this time. Okay, A. When you're closer to the cell body, that means you have more axon to grow back. See, it's like you know it. You know the answer to it, but the wording always throws you off. Don't worry, the test questions are not like that. Okay? Just a thought. Alrighty, we're going to continue on here and get into all the peripheral nerve injuries, not just traumatic, but those that are metabolic, toxic, and genetic. And I think there's one more. Okay, anyway, we're going to start with those that actually are more on your traumatic type of injuries. These are your compression injuries and entrapment. What do I mean by entrapment? Okay, stuck underneath something, squished. So they go together. Compression and entrapment really kind of mean the same thing. Nerves that are getting pressure upon them. That's what we're looking at here. Then we're going to get into the rest, but we're going to start with these compression ones. The first one is such a common one, carpal tunnel syndrome. Now these, everything I'm going to go through now has pretty much the same layout. And this is how I want you to study it, how to learn it, and it is very, very brief. You'll get more detail in the region classes when you get to them, if that's what's needed. So I'm going to talk about the mechanism of injury, the location of injury, the symptoms, and that's pretty much it. Okay, we're not going to get into treatment and all that right now. We're just talking about the disorder, giving you that general information. Part of this is me naming a bunch of peripheral nerves, and that's almost not fair. But it's time to learn them, okay? So you'll learn these nerves even more when you get to the region. For right now, you're just learning the name of it. You'll know the location of the nerve generally by the location of the injury. So the first one, carpal tunnel syndrome. The mechanism that's most common for this occurring is repetitive use of the hand. Typing, knitting, those sort of things. Anything that involves a lot of wrist and hand motion can bring on carpal tunnel syndrome. There's other reasons, pregnancy and all, but that's your main mechanism. The location of the compression or the entrapment is right here at the wrist, and it's of the median nerve. Median runs right down the middle of the wrist, median nerve. The symptoms the patient's going to complain about are pain in the wrist and palm. Pain, that's usually the first symptom that they complain about. And then muscle wasting of the thumb. Now, I'm not talking about out here. I'm talking about here at the base of the thumb. This bulgy muscle will start to go away. And they may not notice that, okay? Most people don't know what their hands really look like. Those are the biggies there, carpal tunnel syndrome. You can see how brief I am on this, okay? We're sticking to just some brief things. It's an introduction class. Tardy ulnar palsy. This one, the mechanism is typically at the elbow, and it's typically because of a bony growth at the elbow. So someone who had an old fracture of the elbow ends up forming some osteophytes, which are just little bony knobs coming out near the fracture site. Now that's typically it, but it can also be due to elbow deformity. And this is like a normal abnormality, okay? So some of you may have this deformity, don't freak out. When you put your arms at your side, your hands are more lateral than your elbows. See how my hands come out to the side? Now I can make it extreme by flexing my elbows, but I'm talking about when your elbows are extended all the way, put them at the side of your trunk, and your hands will stick out a little bit. They're not in line. You see that? It makes a little bit of an L shape coming out. That's called the cubital, which is the elbow word, cubital, valgus, meaning it comes out to the side. Some people, when their arms are extended, have a lot. I'm flexing right now to mimic it. Women have more than men because they have wider hips. It allows them to clear the hips. But some people, because of injuries, have asymmetrical, one out more than the other. Well, no matter the cause, having a lot of cubital valgus puts a traction on the nerve as it runs through the elbow, leading to tardy ulnar palsy. The location is here at your elbow. You know where your funny bone is? That's what you call it? This is the nerve. So if you go to the medial side of your elbow, you should feel a prongy bone and a little indentation before you get to the elbow bone. I'm really being general. The olecranon here. It's in between the two. That's where your ulnar nerve lies. You can twang it and give yourself a good, okay? have fun. It's going to hurt for a while. You can give yourself a neuropraxia by doing that, all right? Just, and you'll feel the tingling. Where do you feel the tingling? In your lateral, your fourth and fifth digit. That's the symptoms the patient complains about. They complain about tingling there, but more so, they get a deformity. Like this, the picture shows it. And they'll have wasting of the muscles, atrophy of the muscles deep in the palm of the hand or on the back side of the hand, the dorsum. And it looks like they just have a bony looking hand is what it ends up looking like. That's your tardy ulnar palsy. The next one, thoracic outlet syndrome. This is a decreased space in the thoracic outlet, which makes perfect sense to me because I know what a thoracic outlet is, but you probably don't. That's the space between your first rib or your rib, cervical rib cage, and your clavicle. Thoracic outlet. What sits in there? We talked about it last class. Brachial plexus. So we're talking about an impingement, an entrapment, a compression of the brachial plexus in this thoracic outlet region. The mechanism for causing this compression is anything from having an additional rib. You know, you can have a cervical rib. Isn't that weird? Okay, you can have a cervical rib. Probably you don't have any here, or you'd have symptoms of thoracic outlet syndrome. It could be that your cervical vertebrae has a really long lateral process, the transverse process sticking out. It could be because you're wearing a backpack that's way too heavy, pushing down on the clavicle, reducing the thoracic outlet space. There's a lot of reason for this. Most commonly, it's because people are doing too much overhead activity. I give myself a thoracic outlet syndrome every time I try to paint a ceiling. Okay, so you might feel it too. Just because of the positions of the bones when you're up in this position reduces that thoracic outlet space there. So the symptom the patient will complain about is pain in their upper extremity. It's kind of a diffuse pain because it affects the brachial plexus, which is all the nerves going into your upper extremity, all the peripheral nerves, and they'll tend to have numbness in the hand. The other thing that runs through the thoracic outlet, besides the brachial plexus, is the brachial artery. So sometimes they'll complain of vascular symptoms as well, if the artery is being compressed. Saturnae palsy, this is the funny one. This one is typically alcohol-related, and it's when your upper extremity not just sleeps in an awkward position, but sleeps with a companion. And that companion puts their head on your arm, right here, okay? What happens is the head of that companion or whatever's there. I've actually know of this happening where a person fell asleep with their arm draped over a bathtub. Okay, so that can happen too. So we're talking about compression of the radial nerve, that's the nerve involved, as it in the upper arm, as the radial nerve compresses on the humerus bone. If you remember, you haven't learned it. When you learn this, when you learn about the humeral bone, there's actually a spot on the bone called the radial groove. And that's where the radial nerve lies, right on the bone. So it can easily get compressed between the bone and whatever pressure is put onto it. And the patient will complain of numbness in the posterior part of the hand, because that's the nerve field of the radial nerve, the patchy nerve field. And they'll have weak extenders of their wrist and fingers, because that's what the radial nerve does. So the extenders of the upper extremity will have weakness and that numbness tingling on the back of the hand. So it's a funny thing, right? You know, ha ha ha, it usually goes away in a little while. But it's a neuropraxia, okay? It can take months if it's very severe. Why do I say alcohol is usually related? Because if you're not drunk, typically you'll wake up because of the pressure, push the person off or whatever, or change your position and get rid of it. Okay, that's why alcohol is usually related in this one. Going along with this is one called crutch palsy. And this is one we really need to know about because we're giving people crutches all the time. This is when someone leans their armpits on their crutches or they have their crutches too high and they actually weight bear on their crutches as they're ambulating. And in doing that, they're getting the radial nerve. They're impinging upon the radial nerve. That's how it's positioned going through the axilla. And they'll have the same exact symptoms. So crutch palsy is one we've really got to be alert to. Okay? And if we send somebody out with their crutches too tall, we're responsible for giving them a neuropraxia. That's not very good therapy. Alrighty, sciatica. Very, very common as far as nerve injuries go. Sciatica, the mechanism of injury is diverse. There's a bunch of things listed there. The most common is your herniated disc. So where is it? Here it is. And I actually found I can apply some traction to the vertebrae here and actually pull it out. So this disc is herniated. See the red thing in there? It's showing how the intervertebral disc is actually pushing anteriorly posteriorly onto the nerve and causing some nerve damage, causing compression or entrapment of that nerve. That nerve in the lumbar spine, I'm having trouble putting it together. Anyway, in the lumbar spine, that nerve is part of the sacral plexus, if it is, and if it is one of those that ends up being the sciatic nerve, which it commonly is, will produce sciatica. The other things listed there, dislocated hip, pretty rare. Spine arthritis, pretty common. That can produce sciatica. Pressure from the pregnant uterus. That's why a lot of pregnant ladies complain of leg pain. And there's a muscle in your butt called the piriformis. And when it gets spasmed, it can put pressure on that sciatic nerve as well. So there's a lot of places where the sciatic nerve can get compressed or entrapped. The complaints are the same. The patient will complain of pain shooting down the back of their leg, maybe all the way down into their foot. That's considered true sciatica when it goes to the foot. And it hurts. Next one, compartment syndrome. I bet a lot of you have experienced a mild form of this. What's happening here, the mechanism is something like a penetrating injury, a contusion, or maybe a cast that doesn't fit well, is putting pressure on a muscle compartment. A muscle compartment is a space occupied by muscle, but that is tightly bound, or is bound, it doesn't have to be tightly, is bound by connective tissue and bone. So you have a space with only so much room in it for the muscles and the vascular structures and the nerve. The nerve's what we're really thinking about here. And something occurs, one of those mechanisms, to cause that space to be taken up with edema, or the last thing listed there, with muscle tissue. Okay, this can happen from training, and that's where I think some of you may have experienced this. We have someone in the senior class who has a problem with this in their forearms. Okay, and what happens here is the muscles, especially if you run on your toes, start to get a little swollen, start to have some edema in them, and they take up that space that is so defined by the connective tissue and the bone. When the space is taken up, the thing that gets impinged or compressed is your vascular structures and your nerves. So you're going to feel pain. The patient will complain of pain. They'll complain of numbness as the nerve has more and more compression on it, and even weakness as the nerve can't provide that stimulation to make muscles contract. If untreated, this can be really, really bad. Okay, it can cause nerve damage to the point where the patient may never get the function back again. Also, it's not just compressing the nerve, it's compressing the vascular structures, which means everything distal to that compression will not be getting the amount of blood it should, will suffer ischemia, and we'll have cell death. So this is actually considered a medical emergency when it gets extreme. And in those cases, they do a fasciotomy. You ready for the yucky pictures? This one's not yucky, but I have another one. A fasciotomy is when they release the connective tissue that's bounding this compartment. Here's the yucky part. You see, so you get a diagram of what's happening here. That allows the pressure to release, the vascular structures to work, the nerve to work. But look, ew, it's nasty, folks. Okay? It looks worse than it really is, though, okay? These things do heal up, and typically they don't suture them back up, do they? No, because that would just put the pressure right back. They are packed, and they're allowed to scar and heal, okay? So they really are visually nasty, but the patients are functional. I actually had a friend who had a fasciotomy because of compartment syndrome, but the mechanism is not one listed here. He had a staph infection. Okay? And he picked it up in the gym. San Antonio is having troubles with staff right now. Please wear flip-flops. Yes? Burn victims, yes, because of the edema of the burn victim. You'll probably see them when you go up to the burn center, somebody with a fasciotomy. Okay? Bites, because of the inflammation. So there's several other mechanisms, as you can see, than what's listed here. Now, not all of it's an emergency. The exercise-induced one, usually those aren't emergencies. They'll test the pressures, and there's a way to test it, and that's kind of gory, too, because they actually have to puncture to test the pressures of the compartment. And if they find it's not in the emergency realm, they treat it with the edema-reducing type treatments, which is your RISOM, rest, ice, compression, elevation, and what's the M? Gentle motion. That's a physical therapy thing. You usually just hear rice, but physical therapy likes gentle motion. All righty. We have another hour. Let's go through another section, and then we can take a break. Metabolic neuropathies. We just have two of them listed here, and the two of them kind of go together in a way. The first one is the diabetic neuropathy. So now we're leaving the realms of traumatic type nerve injuries. All those I listed before are compression entrapment related. So they're kind of on the realms of traumatic, even though you don't think of carpal tunnel syndrome as trauma. Okay, it is. It's repetitive long-term trauma that leads to it. But now we're going into the other things that cause peripheral problems. These are your peripheral neuropathies, nerve problems, neuropathies. the diabetic neuropathy is the most common. The most common. Many people out in our world have diabetes, in the United States especially. The etiology that's related to the neuropathy part of diabetes is that the vascular ability going to the nerve tissue decreases. So what I mean here, I said it kind of awkwardly, your nerves are not going to get their blood flow because of the process that occurs with diabetes. This occurs distally in your periphery, distal, and then works its way proximal. So your diabetic patients are going to present in a very specific way. They're going to complain of a loss of sensation in their feet. And what part of their feet first? Toes. Do they normally recognize they have toe sensation loss? No. Boing, boing, boing. Even though they go to all the education classes, read all the pamphlets, they come in with these Hughes ulcerations on their toe, and they say, I didn't even notice it until just this morning. And you're like, ah. And we're talking like dime-sized sores that go down to their bone. They don't feel them. All right? So even though we know and they know, they still don't feel and they don't recognize. Yes? It's your diabetic patients in general. Now, typically, you know, type 2 diabetes, typically people get that later in life, you know, their adulthood. Not in San Antonio, okay? We have a lot of child diabetics here. This is actually a nationwide trend, but San Antonio is one of the leaders. But it really can be in any age group. The longer the patient has diabetes and the less controlled it is, the quicker they're going to get symptoms like the neuropathy. So it really depends. Okay, so we're talking distal first, but it can be hands or feet. Typically it's feet, but it can be both. So look at the picture. The picture is really the key here. They call it a stocking and glove sensation loss. Okay, because it's feet and hands is where they get it. And it's symmetrical. Diabetes doesn't attack one arm and then the other. It usually attacks both at the same time. So you have a symmetrical weakness, and I'm sorry, sensory loss, later followed by weakness. The sensory loss is first. It's a huge problem. Huge, huge problem. Now, it doesn't just deal with the nerves going to your skin. Diabetes also affects the nerves going to all your special senses. So the patients will have a visual loss, they'll have taste loss, they'll have a lot of loss from the neuropathies. But the hands and feet are what we really, really see. So remember the stocking and glove pattern. You may pick it up on a patient who's not there for their diabetic neuropathy. They're there because they have an ankle sprain. And if you notice other things, you may be the first one to pick up early diabetes. All right, so I said these two metabolic neuropathies kind of go together, diabetes and alcohol. It's kind of like the vices because, you know, diabetes, you think of a lot of sugar intake, uncontrolled diet, that's your type 2. Your obese patient, and then so you have a vice there, food, high-calorie food, and the other vice being alcohol intake. The alcohol neuropathy, interestingly, there's still some discussion as to what the mechanism is that's causing the nerve death. Is it actually a toxicness to the alcohol, or is it the nutritional deficit that goes along with alcoholism? Or is it just a combo of both? Okay, so it's still not 100% clear as to what's going on. I like to just think of it as both. The alcohol itself is toxic as well as the nutritional deficit that alcoholics suffer. So together that causes neurotissue death. And similar to diabetes, it happens distally first and works its way proximally. But your alcoholics won't have much upper extremity problems initially. There, it's almost always in the feet. And you can hear an alcoholic neuropathy patient as they come into the clinic. They walk heavy. Why? Because they're not getting the proprioceptive and sensory input from their feet to help them with foot placement and equilibrium and balance, so they get the auditory. Okay, listen in your halls, in the dorms. who's coming in at 2 o'clock? Okay, I hope we don't have any alcoholics in the barracks. But anyway, that's a very, very typical thing, to have that pounding to help them with their sensory input. They hear it, and they slam their feet down to feel it. So that's the first thing. It's also bilateral. Going along with the sensory loss is the weakness. They have, along with the sensory need for slapping, they just don't have the strength of the feet to walk heel toe, so they walk flat-footed, and that gives you that noise as well. If that's not enough to scare you guys to be moderate in your drinking, and I say guys, it also will produce very early in the alcoholic neuropathy state incontinence and impotence. So that might have some effect. You got to hit them where it hurts. All right. Now the prognosis for alcohol neuropathies is permanent. However, there is some reversal of symptoms if you can catch it early. All right, so we're not talking, you don't say, oh, well, I already got it, I might as well just drink myself to death. Okay, there is some recovery involved. With the diabetic neuropathies, not as good. Okay, but if you can control your diabetes, then you will not progress. That's the good part there. Yes? Diabetes. I just think of that with alcoholic because of the blood perfusion. Okay. And it's also Irish. It's also an Irish thing. A lot of Irish people are alcoholics. I mean, go figure. But with the skin condition of those from that sort of area, the northern climates, they get rosacea, which has a lot to do with the bulbousness. A lot. So the alcoholic will be more perfused during alcohol intake peripherally, like in their skin, which gives them the redness, and can result over time in that, but it's the rosacea, an actual dermatology problem, that really gives the big ears and the big nose. Me and my husband both have rosacea, so we kind of laugh. What are we going to look like when we're 90, if we make it that far? Funny ears and all. Yes. It will depend on how much toxin, how much alcohol they're taking in, so that will have an effect on it. I really don't know enough about it to answer that. I would think that each person has their own tolerance, because part of it is nutritional as well too. But I really don't know enough to talk about that. We all have our concerns. I mean, not just for us, but people we love and all that. So. I will say, with the alcoholic neuropathy patients I've seen have all been old. Okay, so I guess it takes some time. But that's just going back to the research class yesterday. That's my clinical observation. All right, so that's the lowest end of the totem pole there. This is something, folks, you have access to all the medical research out there for free. I know you have very busy days, but when you get to your hospitals, too, you have access. This is where you put in the keywords, alcoholism, peripheral neuropathy, and see what's out there. Okay, sometimes the research article itself may not be what you're looking for, but in that introduction of the article, when it summarizes, we're going to finish up this class on peripheral nerve injuries, looking at the rest of the neuropathies. There's really not a whole lot left, and then we'll do some review after that. Alrighty, we just finished up the metabolic neuropathies. Besides the alcohol neuropathy, what's the other metabolic neuropathy? Diabetes. Diabetes. And so when we're talking about metabolics, okay, I hope that category makes sense to you. We also talked about a whole bunch of compression and entrapment type injuries, with the Saturday night palsy. Which nerve gets injured with that? You might show, well, show me the area. Where does it happen? Okay, radial nerve. Good. Compression here, radial nerve against the humerus. What's the other way you can get a radial nerve injury? We don't call it Saturnate palsy. It has another name, but if I tell you it, I'm giving it away. Crutch palsy. So radial nerve, same symptoms, different location, either against the humerus or up in the axilla. What is it called when the muscle tissue compresses upon the nerve because the space is too tight? Compartment syndrome. Good. How about in the elbow? Do you remember that one? That one has a funny name. It does. Tardy ulnar palsy, because that's the ulnar nerve. Tardy ulnar palsy. Don't ask me why it's tardy. Okay. Oh, papers. Okay, so now we'll continue along here, and we're going to talk about, here's my public announcement about the metabolic neuropathies. Moderation, folks, moderation. We're going to go into the infectious neuropathies now. And we have three we're going to look at here. Infectious, we're talking about viral, bacterial, or fungal. We're just going to really stick to the viral, bacterial, and how viruses, bacteria can affect the nerves. The first one is Guillain-Barré. French. Guillain-Barré. Don't say Guillain-Barré. All right? You won't sound good. Guillain-Barré syndrome. You will see this abbreviated as GBS as well. I like saying Guillain-Barré, so I never call it GBS. The etiology for this is actually unknown. This is a common occurrence in the neuro field. Hopefully, 5 years from now, we'll have a lot of knowns. But there is a lot known about Guillain-Barré. And the thing that is known is that it's associated with a recent viral or bacterial infection, surgery, or vaccination. Usually one of those events precedes the onset of Guillain-Barré. That's why they say it is in somehow an infectious neuropathy. You may have experienced this, not so much having it yourself. It's not that common, but it's not so rare that a typical hospital doesn't have a case or two a year. Okay, it does happen. What's happening is the peripheral nerves demyelinate in response to this infection. And when that happens, the patient complains of weakness. It occurs from distal to proximal. You see the trend? Okay, distal to proximal. And it occurs symmetrically. The weakness can come on pretty quickly. So it can be a very scary situation, especially since the weakness can go so proximally that it affects the respiratory muscles. It affects the respiratory muscles, you have respiratory distress, and if there's no medical treatment, you have death. So there is the possibility here of it being fatal, but usually, you know, people go, this is weird, you know, I can't use my hands, I'm having trouble walking, and they see medical attention, and usually it's picked up pretty quickly, and they're in the hospital before respiratory distress occurs, all right? So I don't want you to, you know, get nervous here. Usually the prognosis is good because there's medical attention, and it doesn't always go to respiratory distress. The symptoms typically peak within 2 to 4 weeks, and then the symptoms reverse over the course of a year. This is a pain in the neck thing, right? Your poor patient, life changes for them. But the good news is they typically get full function back. And that's good because a lot of neurological disorders, the prognosis is not so good. Okay? In this case, it sure is a pain in the neck. It takes a good year, but prognosis is pretty solid. So that is Guillain-Barré. The next one is pretty common, shingles. This is an infectious disorder of the herpes zoster virus. You know of it as producing chickenpox. How many of you had chickenpox? Wow, really? You guys weren't vaccinated? You were vaccinated and you got it anyway, but you got it milder, right? That's what they say. Okay, good. Wow, that's amazing. I didn't expect so many hands to go up. All right, so it's the same virus. Literature says if you've had chickenpox, you're less likely to have the shingles. But it's a dormancy. The virus lies dormant and then re-expresses itself when you least want it to in the form of not chickenpox, but as shingles. Okay, so there's a lot of controversy in the literature about this. I shouldn't even have mentioned that. Where it presents itself is along the thoracic peripheral nerves. Now, it can present itself elsewhere, but that's the most common location. And at first it presents, the patient will complain of a rash. That's the initial symptoms. The rashes will blister, scar over, and at some point the rashes will be accompanied by pain. Ouchy, really severe pain. My dad had this. I mean, the guy's like one of these tough guys, but he was in tears. This was really uncomfortable for him. Some patients do get a milder form, and it's not so bad, but typically it's very, very painful. It can progress to motor weakness, too, so it can be more than just sensory. Yes? Yes, it's superficial. It's along that nerve distribution, so it doesn't go into the guts and the innards. It stays out there, but it's one of those you just can't touch. It's like a weird sensation pain. Normally we don't get a lot of thorax pain. We get it in our extremities. We're not used to having it up there. The prognosis, however, is very good because it does reverse itself. It just takes a long time, and it can come back. Okay? It's not one of those that you get it once and you're done. You paid the price. It can come back. The virus can go dormant again and represent. The next one is Bell's palsy. And you know how I keep saying I'm hoping in 5 years we know more, we can treat more, or all this stuff. This is one of these that actually we do know more. When I first learned it, we didn't know it as an infectious neuropathy. It was a mystery. Now we do know it as an infectious neuropathy. It's associated with the herpes simplex virus in 80% of the cases. So there are still some mystery components to it, but at least we got this down. It is a infection of the cranial nerve number 7. So what's the cranial nerve number 7? Facial. What does it do? Facial expression or facial sensation? Expression. Okay, so we're talking motor. Motor to the facial muscles. And if you have trouble with getting those two confused, this might help you remember it. Cranial nerve number 7, Bell's palsy. Yes. That's what I was taught back in 1990. You don't see that in the literature anymore. Okay, so it's kind of moving beyond that. That there now that could be, because you know we don't want to take all the stuff that was taught before and say no. It could be that that can spark the virus to take effect. That the virus is there, the herpes, because this is another one that lies dormant and then expresses itself. So those conditions of cold air flow can promote the virus to take its effect. So I'm not going to totally discredit it, but now we're looking more at it being the viral agent, and those other things we did learn might come into play in making the virus come alive, come out of its dormancy. So what happens with these patients? They get muscle weakness because it's cranial nerve number 7. And that muscle weakness expresses just unilaterally on one side of the body. So unilateral facial weakness. Now, it can be bilateral, but typically it's unilateral. Of those 20% that aren't associated with the virus, some of those are associated with an actual compression due to some sort of tumor growth or edema where cranial nerve number 7 comes out of the cranium. So there are some actual compression reasons for getting Bell's palsy as well. But if you look at the picture, and let me see if I have it, there she is, of the girl, in the one picture she's trying to smile, you can see how one side of her face is smiling. And it kind of helps if you cover up the Bell's palsy side and you see, oh yeah, she's smiling. And then look at the other side and you got kind of a mask-like, no expression. In the other one, she's told to close her eye. So on the same side, you can see how she's closing the eye. On the other side, she is closing her eyes, but it's not as tight. Not as tight. And you have this picture in your handout as well, I believe. So the symptoms are that unilateral weakness, one-sided weakness, very, very annoying to the patients because we use our faces to express a lot, to communicate a lot. It also has problems with drooling. If you don't have that muscle control around your mouth, you do have drooling problems and speech articulation problems. I have a neighbor, sweet old neighbor, who we always have a Christmas party, invite her every year she comes. I really look forward to seeing her. And she wouldn't come 1 year because she had Bell's palsy. She was too embarrassed to leave the house. Now look how long it takes for this to go away. It does take months. 6 months is the average, and it spontaneously goes away. Back when I went through physical therapy school, we were told to treat these patients. Research showed that treating them helped no good at all, okay? So we are essentially, we're treating them, putting them through different activities and e-stimming them and doing all this stuff, but it wasn't getting them better any quicker. So insurance companies won't pay for that anymore. And it's not a good use of our time or our patients' time. They usually respond spontaneously. And as they recover, if they're not getting their strength back, then therapy has shown to be beneficial to get the strength back. So they have to first have the viral infection part decrease, and then therapy can be effective. So those were your infectious. Now we go to the toxic. I don't really talk a whole lot about the toxic agents because this list is long. In the front. This list is really, really long. There's a lot of toxins out there that affect nerves. And through the military, we use toxins to affect nerves. Actually, you know, we're not. But anyway, there are toxins out there used in warfare that are nerve agents, and you all know that. But I'm going to talk about the number one that is not necessarily military number one, that's lead poisoning. This is a toxic poison to the nerves, and that's the main symptom that the patients have, is the neuropathy associated with lead poisoning. Believe it or not, people are still ingesting lead, and some of it's voluntarily. It tastes good. Those little paint chips that have lead in them, from old houses where the paint is peeling. It's beyond me why anyone would eat peeling paint, but it still happens. It still happens. And really, I've been told it tastes good. No. So don't try it on your own. Take my word for it tastes good, but don't taste it because it is toxic, okay? Yes. Okay. So it's not necessarily in this case, he might have just been gnawing on something to gnaw. And the paint got into him. It's not necessarily, I think I'll eat this. Okay, but that happens. It still happens. It happens a lot, despite a lot of public advertisement against it. So that's one way that getting lead ingestion, but there's other industrial ways. There's a lot of industrial things that put lead toxin into the air. Or in dust, should put it that way, into dust, which gets taken into the body. Batteries. Okay, so there's just a lot of different things out there that can provide lead poisoning to us. What this does is actually go into the cell body of a neuron, and it disrupts the organelle functioning. So we get cell death, because once you mess with the cell body, the cell cannot restore itself. Neurons do not have that ability to divide, to mitose, after you've been born. So you have all the neurons you're going to have. You can only get less. Okay? They can bud and regrow axons, but they cannot produce another neuron after you've been born. So you got the most you got right now. Okay, so how do these patients present? This is kind of interesting. Kids and adults present different in accordance to lead poisoning. With children, they'll have lower extremity weakness as their main problem. or their main symptom. With adults, it's upper extremity weakness. I have no idea why. I've looked and I can't find an explanation. So I don't know why, that's just how it is. But that's how it first presents. For both adults and children, it can progress to include the entire body. Okay, so it can get there. The interesting thing with this is that the cell organelles will be disrupted, but death does not occur immediately in those cells. They live a while in a dysfunctional state, producing weakness, but the cell does not necessarily die right away. So the good news is you take away the toxin and you can reverse the symptoms up until a point. At some point, the cell will die, and there is no reversal. But you can reverse it if you catch it pretty, I wouldn't say so much early on, but if you catch it early to moderate on. And then you can restore the neurons, the organelles, using vitamin therapy. So there's a way to actually help these people get better, which is great. Then I have kind of the generic saying that pesticides, insecticides, and there are various, numerous of those, and war agents can affect the nerve cells toxically. And really, you need to, if there's any in particular you're interested, just hit the internet. You'll find a lot of information on them. Okay? And that's all I'm going to say. Aluminum, there's always a big question out there with aluminum. The latest thing I saw, it's a bunch of baloney. So don't go ahead and drink from those aluminum cans. But you never know. You never know what the next research will find. All right, the last of our neuropathies. This is one you've already had before. Motor end plate disorders. And you say, what? I never had motor end plate disorders. I'm throwing a new term out at you. We talked about a disorder of a synapse. When a synapse occurs between a neuron and a muscle, it's called neuromuscular. Okay, there's another term for it. Motor end plate. You got to know all the terms. You just got to know them all. So here's just another way of presenting the same disorder using a different generic or overturn here, the motor end plate disorders. And that disorder is myasthenia gravis. You remember this one? It's a disorder where the receptors for the neurotransmitter are destroyed, autoimmune. They're destroyed. And therefore, when the presynaptic terminal releases the neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft, and all these terms should be in there, okay? That neurotransmitter doesn't get uptaked by the postsynaptic terminal. There's not enough receptor sites to pull it in and produce an action potential or a depolarization of that muscle cell. So in essence, the muscle doesn't contract in response to the synaptic activity. These patients show this mostly in cranial nerves. So the muscles that cranial nerves go to will show a lot of weakness. The rest of the body could show diffuse and mild weakness. That's usually how it presents. So think of what the cranial nerves do. We had three cranial nerves on eyes, and that's where these patients typically complain of the most problems, is with their eye function. They have weakness of the eyes, facial muscles. That's a cranial nerve innervation. They have a mask-like appearance. They don't really smile. When you have that, your face falls into a slight grimace, so they typically look like they're kind of angry. And they have trouble with their eyelids, keeping them open, so they have these droopy eyelids. They also have autonomic motor problems to their cranial nerves, which involves accommodating the lens, so you can see near and far, and adjusting the pupil size. So they have visual disturbances as well. Those are their main complaints, the visual disturbances and the face muscle weakness. But they can have it all over. And you guys have probably heard of multiple sclerosis. That's an autoimmune disorder too. Different type of autoimmune. But multiple sclerosis, you may know, it comes and it goes. They go into remissions, and then it might get worse or it might not. Same idea with this. Autoimmune disease sometimes have that tendency to come and go. So that happens with this too. They get bad, they go into remission where they're fine for a while, then they get bad and back and forth. Usually not fatal. All right, I think this is the actual last one. The genetic disorder. So we talked about a lot. This is your genetic one. And this one I throw in here because you're going to see it in physical therapy. These patients come to physical therapy because of the neuropathy. It has a long name, Charcot-Marie Tooth Disease. So we have Dr. Charcot, Dr. Marie, and Dr. Tooth, and no one could decide who should get the disorder named after them, so all of them joined in. So it's a long name. It's an inherited genetic disorder that presents itself around adulthood, adolescence, young adulthood, in that frame. So pretty much most of you are probably beyond that stage or just about to be beyond it. The patient will present with unusual lower extremities. That's how I'm going to generically put it. Specifically, they have high arches. They have weakness in their foot. So and we're talking the lower leg. So the calf muscles, they're the weak ones. So controlling their ankle motion, they have weakness. Within the intrinsic of their foot, they would it too. Toes, that's where the weakness displays itself. Very mild sensory loss, but there is a sensory component to it as well. And the picture is the big thing that kind of tells you that they have this disorder. They have a very characteristic look to their legs, and it's called a champagne glass deformity, because their calves will be so teeny that it's really like tibias with some muscles attached, a little bit of muscle, but they're really walking on their tibs with very little muscle. And then they have quadriceps and hamstrings, so they have a normal size thigh. That's what gives them the champagne glass deformity. Woo, we did it. That's all the disorders. Now we're just going to talk about how to treat them. This doesn't take long at all. This is a very generic treatment. You'll get more specifics when you get to those regions of the body. In general, though, you get someone with neuropathy, you're going to go through these main categories of rehabbing them. First of all, neuropathies. You have a nerve that's not going to a muscle or making the muscle weak. So distally, they might go into some positionings that are not functional. If they have a radial nerve neuropathy, well, they can't extend their wrist, so they get into this position. We talked about that older tardy, where they have the clawing of the last two digits there. So there's a lot of different positions they can go into. Your diabetics, they don't dorsiflex their ankles, so they get what's called a foot drop, where the foot hangs down. They can get actually stuck in plantar flexion if they don't get out of bed, which some of them don't do. So these deformities can occur. Let me move on here. And it's our job to make sure they don't occur. We do that by doing range of motion so that the entire motion is kept. They don't get contracted, meaning their muscles don't tight them up and get them stuck in those deformities. And then we use splinting or bracing for when they're at a rest or in rest to hold them into a functional position. So this would be a functional type brace for the hand, putting them in this position. For the foot, giving them an L-shaped brace so they don't go into that foot drop when they're sitting or lying down. So there are braces and splints for particular neuropathies to keep them in a functional position. Range of motion first, and then bracing. Notice I say no slings. Slings are you think of those for the arm. They hold the arm. Very unfunctional. Very, very unfunctional. And they actually promote deformities. Okay, so they actually promote shoulder problems and forearm problems. So very rarely with a neuropathy do you use something like a sling. We use splints and braces. They're for functional positioning. Slings are more to put something at rest. We don't use those with neuropathies. Strengthening. If you have a muscle that's not getting a nerve, can you make it stronger? Oh, the Russians. I think of that movie with Rocky. How did they strengthen the Russian? Yeah, they used electricity. They pumped him up with electricity. It's not good therapy, folks, okay? Not only does it really not work, but if it does work, that means it's painful and continuous. All right? You don't just put him on for a half hour, okay? So if you have a muscle that doesn't have a nerve innervating it, because it's still growing or it's neuropathied, it's dead, you cannot strengthen that muscle. all right? With electricity, it's not good therapy. And you can't strengthen it by having it do exercises. You need the neural input to actually strengthen. So why do I have this on here? Because a lot of neuropathies, the entire muscle is not cut off from the nerves, only part of it. So you can strengthen what is connected. It might be a weak muscle, but there's some connection. So you can strengthen it. You don't over-strengthen it. You mildly strengthen it because you don't want to overtax the nerves that are working. Okay, so you do strengthen. If you have some innervation, you do strengthen to a certain degree. Biofeedback. That is when you hook the machine up on the muscle so that as it moves, you see the electrical impulses of that muscle. You see the muscle working. This works. You use it on patients that are getting their innervation back. It's a way of reteaching their brain how to make the muscle use by giving them more visual input. They see the little thing go on the computer screen and they're, oh yeah, I'm using it. It gives them input to help them re-educate that muscle. So we do use that. Preventing edema. Edema is just a killer. You get edema and a whole lot of other things go wrong. With neuropathies, especially your diabetes, your alcohol neuropathy, and the compression syndromes, edema is kind of, it's a side, what am I looking for? What's that word? It happens along with it. A side effect, okay, of the neuropathy. So you want to reduce it as much as possible, because if you have edema, it's going to cause stiffness. If you have edema, it's going to cause more compression of the nerves and other tissue. So you do what you can to reduce edema using the principles we already mentioned, the Rysum principles. There's something called a Jobe's pump. There's a picture of it. It's an actual way to pump the edema out of the extremity. You'll get to play with that towards the end of the course and pump each other's extremities there and get the edema out if you have any. If not, it's still kind of fun to mess with the machine. We have Jobe's pump here. I don't think it's called a Jobe's pump. I don't know what the actual term, certain read does. That actually involves using chirotherapy, which is ice. So it uses cooled water, I believe, is in it, which pumps at the same time. And that's really cool because now we're using two components of the rice. And if you do it in an elevated position, now you got three. Okay, what's the machine called?
Game ready.
Yes, so you'll get to mess with that one, too, when the time comes. You also want to educate the patient, because there's a lot of ways that you can educate them to reduce edema. For instance, don't wear something that has a tight wrist. Or, you know, you've seen the socks, right? They got those socks that have a really tight end to them up on the calf, and then that it doesn't allow the edema to come out of the leg. It just captures it down there. So you educate them on wearing loose-fitting clothes, not wearing jewelry that will bind, not carrying their purse in such a way or their bags that will cause any sort of compression and not allow the edema to move proximally like it should. So there's a lot of education involved. You'll have a full class on this come 4 months from now. Next thing, sensory re-education. This involves the sensory component of neuropathies. You have a neuropathy, patient loses their sensation. Well, if you reverse the neuropathy through vitamins, through allowing time for the nerve to grow back, well, eventually, hopefully, you'll get sensation back. But the problem is the patient will be hypersensitive to the sensation they get back. And it's a big problem. Big problem. So from early on, when the symptoms present, you start desensitizing the patient to normal touch. It can be as much as just telling them to massage, if they can already handle that and there's no problem to it. But if they already are hypersensitive, you desensitize them by taking different types of fabrics or materials, starting with the softest, most unirritating. Get them used to that and move up to more and more irritating fabrics. An example would be going from soft cotton to sandpaper. And you do that. You get them used to feeling rough things or wool, something rough. We have machines that also help to desensitize. We have one that blows sawdust. Use this for other reasons too, but you can use it to desensitize. There's a lot of ways you can do it. So going back to that list, oops, wrong way. viewing back, there's immersion into certain substances like sawdust, sand, getting into more irritating things. There's brushing with different types of fibers. The whole idea is to go from least irritating to irritating, but still in the realms of normal. You would never, like, you know, brush the skin off. Nothing that irritating. With that in mind, look at the last comment up there. If you're going to do any desensitization, you got to make sure you're not doing it over an open wound. Your diabetics, they typically have open wounds. So, okay, if you're seeing them, that's usually why you're seeing them. You wouldn't want to do any sort of desensitization over an open wound because you'll cause an infection. And I know it sounds so obvious, but sometimes the obvious needs to be stated. Okay? So the last thing is patient education. Neuropathies take a long time to heal. It's nothing easy, so you have to educate your patient, first of all, on the prognosis and how the therapy is going to go, but you also have to let them know how they can help the therapy. They help it by using their extremity as much as possible. Don't baby it. Don't self-splint it, because you're going to give yourself more problems. Use it as much as you can. And that's why kids are such good natural rehabbers, because they use their extremities when they're sore. Once they start feeling better, they use them. Adults, we baby them. Oh, baby, baby. Next thing in there is we have to educate them on the fact that they may not have their full sensory input. And because of that, they're in danger. If you cannot sense pain and if you cannot sense temperature, you're more likely to cause injury. Why do diabetics come to see us? Because they get ulcerations. Why? Because they don't feel the little rock in their shoe or the toenail that should have been cut. And because of that, they get a wound, it gets infected, it becomes a crater. We have to educate them to take care of their body and be careful of heat, of irritating things, so they don't get an infection or a wound. Whew! And the last one is really obvious. They're a part of the rehab, and this is good for anything we see patients of. They are a part of it. They need to understand their problem, understand the rehab. They'll just be a better teamwork then. Ah, Sierra Nevada, mountains.